Hi, I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
And like I said earlier, a substance abuse engineer. Let's see, in the beginning there was light. Well, I won't go that far back, but you know, I'm the third son of Fred in Virginia, was born in September of 1954. And like a lot of us, you know, grew up in a loving household and, you know, but, you know, I knew there was something different about me the whole time. I have a learning disability. I don't know exactly. They probably have three letters for it today, but at that time, I have some kind of dyslexia. But in the 1950s and 60s, unless you wrote backwards, they couldn't figure it out. So I had a really hard time reading. And so, which by the time I went to school, it made it so I really didn't fit in. And, you know, I can look back at most of my life and a lot of things I just didn't fit in, and I ended up becoming a loner, you know. I get off the school bus and, you know, get my dog. And back then the Kempsville area was like a lot of, like this area used to be, just wide open fields and, you know, places, great places to grow up. I feel sorry for the kids nowadays, I really do. But, you know, like I said, I was the third son of Fred in Virginia. And you know, for a lot of y'all that can remember the late 50s, early 60s, it was pretty much a cookie cutter world. Everybody seemed to wear the same clothes, drive the same cars. And, you know, when you didn't fit in, you just didn't fit in. But, you know, I grew up in church, you know. But, you know, it's funny, I can look back now and I had two uncles. Well, one was a great uncle and one was an uncle that were alcoholics. And I didn't know as a small kid that they were alcoholics, but I was always attracted to them. You know, especially my Uncle Curtis. I thought he was so cool because he put a cigarette packs in his shirt and, you know, he had a belt buckle that said Slits and, you know, I just thought he was just so cool. But even though I got older and as a teenager watched him die an alcoholic death, you know, did I think that would happen to me? Did I, you know, and, you know, it's like it never dawned on me that I was, you know, I possess that gene. You know, I feel like I was born alcoholic. You know, I had a little toe tag just said, add alcohol, you know. But because, you know, I can remember, you know, or any of y'all from the area originally, do you remember Ocean View Amusement Park? When I was like 13 years old, there was an amusement park on the bay in Norfolk called Ocean View Amusement Park. And it had like this tunnel of love. And we had snuck a bottle of a gin onto this tunnel of love, and we drank as much as we could. We're like 13 years old, you know. And there was a boat ride. So we stuck the bottle down about halfway through the boat ride and then took the ride again to grab the bottle again. So that night, you know, I was with a church group, like, you know. Of course, most of the stuff growing up in church, you know, a lot of my firsts were in church, you know, fell in love for the first time in church, you know, got in my first fight at church, you know, you know, just the typical boy stuff. And in the church group, that night I had my first blackout and wondering, you know, people telling me I did this and did that and don't remember anything. And that was kind of, even back then, that was kind of a bad feeling. But, you know, I realized early on that alcohol was really my first love. You know, I did fall in love with girls, but, you know, but when I started, you know, a lot of people say like marijuana leads to harder drugs. Well, alcohol led to everything with me on my tree of woe. And I mean, whoa. But, you know, I think that if I hadn't have been drinking, I wouldn't have tried other drugs, you know, because you're hanging with the crowd And so alcohol was my first love, but drugs became my wicked mistress. And, you know, it seems like it was a big deal when I realized at a very young age that I had a alcohol, I didn't know it was a problem, but I knew that if all I did was drink, that I'd be the kid that was puking in a little trash can in the corner of the room at all these parties and stuff. So I started experimenting with different, you know, speed and you know, acid and other drugs to try to keep me from you know, the alcohol from taking over. But the problem with that is, you know, when the drug wore out, then the, you know, your body, you know, the alcohol really kicked in, and that's when I got in the most problems, you know. But there was a song in my my senior year by the Doors called "Riders on the Storm," and that was like that's my theme song of my drinking and drugging days, because the lyrics go, "Into this house." Into this house we're born, into this world we are thrown. And I do believe I was born in the house of alcoholism. And, you know, but later on, you know, as obviously I wasn't that good at school, but I did, you know, like playing sports. So I knew when high school was getting ready to end that was like, you know, I was going to miss it because, you know, where else could I have been with 300 or 400, you know, pretty girls? Because I was definitely girl crazy. But, but, you know, time went on and, you know, you think, you know, like when after high school, all these other kids were going to college and my grades weren't good enough. You know, I ended up going to community college, which was high school too. but you know, you think that, you know, so all the friends you surround yourself with when you become a drinker are other kids that drank. And so I thought I was leaving these other kids behind that were going to college, and they, you know, they were leaving me behind. So, you know, I stayed home and worked in the family business, and, you know, I tried school, but if you're a poor reader, you know, most of these college classes, you know, they don't test you on what you talk about during class. They tell you read the next 10 chapters, and that's what you get tested on. And if you're a poor reader, you have 3 or 4 classes that you're supposed to read the next 10 chapters. There's no way in heck that I could, you know, keep up with it. So, needless to say, you know, I met a young lady and fell in love, and we got married. So I quit school and went to work full time, and but you know, the poor girl. Which I was telling somebody earlier that, you know, last month we've been married 50 years now, but it has been a roller coaster ride, mostly for her. But because y'all know how it is being the spouse of an alcoholic. What was so ironic about it is her father was an alcoholic, and her mother died, and all her siblings were separated, and that's how she ended up here. And so she went from the frying pan into the fire with me. And, you know, I made the comment that, you know, I've been married 50 years and my wife worships the ground I'm going to be buried in. But and that's a true story. It tells some other time, you know. Oh, well, I'll tell it to y'all since y'all are my new best friends. she was working one Saturday, and I had the Saturday off. We worked at the same company by then. You know, my father was the president. And some guy came to the door, and I recognized him. He worked at one of the restaurants I called on, and he was selling funeral plots. Well, I had a little buzz on by then, and I decided, well, that's a good idea. I'm like 25 years old. You know, why don't I buy me some funeral plots? And I didn't even ask her permission, and I just bought them. That would have been okay if I was the one that sat there and every month and stroked the check for the payment. But I was always at Jerry's, the bar down, you know, one of my hangouts. So, you know, so every month she had to write that check. It was a resentment. So she owns the ground that I'm going to be, you know. Of course, now she says she's just going to sell the plots and throw me in the backyard somewhere. But, you know, I guess, you know, her sticking around, she must really love me, because I definitely, she never knew if the easy-go-lucky drunk or the demon-possessed drunk was going to show up. You know, she never knew, because, you know, I was a blackout drinker. And, you know, sometimes I remember coming home, and sometimes I didn't. I mean, sometimes I would get stuff in the mail, and this is before computers. I would get stuff in the mail that when I got home, that I was watching TV and ordered and used my charge card and don't even remember ordering it. Stuff like antiquing kits, you know, the antique furniture. I said, what in the hell is this stuff? You know, when you're drunk, I guess it sounded like a pretty good idea. But, and mostly for a long time, I was an easy-go-lucky drunk. But, you know, this the thing about alcoholism, it evolves into from bad to even worse. And then something happened, and, you know, that changed me. And it was my father passed away. And, you know, he's the man I worked for. And, you know, and I never really got to tell him that he was my hero and how much, you know, I tried to tell him how much I loved him. But, you know, he was one of those World War II guys that didn't, you know, he would never tell me that he loved me. You know, and that affected me. I tell you, it did. I think all guys want their father to think highly of them, and not that he didn't in his own way, but you know, I wanted to hear it, I guess. But anyway, he passed away, and I was unexpectedly cut out of the family business. So I went into like a, you know, I was a drinker already, but I went into, you know, I had a pretty much an alcoholic nervous breakdown. And, you know, I'm sure when I got drunk, I would just be whining and crying about everything. And, but anyway, it led for me to be bottom bouncing for like 7 years. And, you know, and because my father was a religious man, you know, I decided I was going to be pissed at God about the whole thing. So for 7 years, I sure showed him. So, needless to say, you know, that 7 years to getting the DUIs and, you know, the drunken in publics and, you know, I would go to bars and they knew me. I said, well, whatever you do, if I get really shit, oops, really messed up, don't try to take my keys away. Just let me go and call the police. But no, everybody would try to take my keys away. And I go to bars sometimes. I go to the bartender, hey man, you got a black eye? Said, yeah, you gave it to me, you know, I wouldn't even remember, you know. I mean, it got so that I wasn't welcome in a lot of places because I became so angry. And I don't know about y'all, but, you know, anger is something that, you know, if you wake up angry, you're going to be angry all day, you know. Anger is something that I've had to learn to work on for a lot of years now. And, but anyway, when I finally hit my big bottom, you know, I came to from a blackout, and I came to and my house was at wreck and my wife was gone. So I knew that I was in some kind of trouble, and I was, you know, like I said, the DUIs and the, you know, getting arrested and all didn't do anything, but, you know, thinking that I could have killed my wife. I mean, she did get hurt, and you know, I did get charged for it, and, you know, and it's something that is, you know, stayed with me. You can't get rid of domestic violence. And, but to think that, you know, all those years I'd come to and like tiptoe around the house and, you know, hope that I didn't do anything stupid. Well, I finally did something so stupid that, you know, I ended up living with, you know, one of my brothers for a while I had the restraining order on. And that's when I was like 44 years old and had never been to an AA meeting. It's kind of, you know, I think about it now and how in the hell did I avoid not going to an AA meeting before then? But so I went, got into AA, you know, got serious about it. So my mom, who was very spiritual, and she didn't know anything about AA, so she was concerned that I might be joining a cult. So she asked me for some of the literature. So I gave her a big book. And the next day she gives me the big book back. She read the whole big book in a day and said, "Gary, this is where you belong." But of course, you know, did I ever listen to mom? At least at first. And of course I went to AA, but I guess what happened was in jail, you know, when I was beating myself up, but can't believe what had happened, you know, somebody handed me a Gideon's Bible, and I opened it up sort of in the middle, and it ended up being on the first chapter of Psalms. And that psalm is about being a righteous man. And so I made a promise to God right then that if I got out of that trouble, that I would, I'd start working for him instead of working for the other guy. But, you know, but I didn't know anything about AA when I made that promise. And I really thought that I was supposed to be a preacher with a Rolex watch or a missionary. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I have visions of grandeur. But, you know, we don't think small, but I made that promise, and so I joined the church, and I thought going to church was, you know, equal to going to AA meetings, but I really didn't understand how alcoholism worked. Even, there was a couple times in my life I quit drinking for a year by myself, but I didn't understand that once you put it back into your body, you're off to the races again. It's not you, it's that other person. And so, you know, I'd get a year and go, well, I deserve a reward. Well, what I'd give myself was not a reward. I'd be off, you know. But anyway, that happened to me in my first time at Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did, you know, I do remember this. I remember I was suggested that I do 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't know why, but I did it. At the time, I didn't have a job, and it seemed to be, you know, getting sober was my job. But, you know, mixing, there's nothing wrong with going to church, don't get me wrong. Some of my happiest times were when I had an AA family and a church family. But, you know, I started going to church too much and not going in it. You know, made my home group one that only met once a week on Saturday nights, and I always had an excuse not to go. So, you know, I initially, even after I joined AA, set myself up because, you know, you quit calling your sponsor, you quit going to meetings, you know, we're alcoholics, we can justify anything. And so the next thing I know is justifying, well, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic, but so, and it started off, you know, some lady asked me if I wanted to smoke some pot with her. And I said, well, I still belong to AA and smoke some pot. And some people do that marijuana maintenance thing, But I smoked that pot and something clicked in the back of my head and I was off to the races for 6 months. That it was just amazing how far down I went in 6 months. Luckily, I didn't get any trouble with the law, but you know, I got in trouble with my wife, that's for sure. But it's, you know, finally when the light finally turned on that I needed to go back to a meeting, when I went to my home group, you know, to see those familiar faces and hear those familiar voices were like beacons of light coming out of the darkness. And for first time in my life, you know, I said, you know, I took my mother's advice, this is where I belong. And today I can look at it and my promise with God is, you know, if I'm going to meetings and I'm talking to other alcoholics and I'm trying to be, you know, the person that I need to be, you know, I'm working for God, you know. But it's like, you know, it's like when you see the moon, like this morning, tonight there was a little slither of a crescent moon. You know, the moon itself is just a rock. But the light that we see from the moon is a reflection from the sun. And today, you know, I try to, in my life, in my program, in my higher power, I try to be a reflection of those things. I try to be part of the light of this world. Instead, I was part of the darkness. let's see. You know, in God's light, we can see light. You know, but a lot of us lived in the darkness for a long time, and it's hard. You know, that's one thing that I think that the founders of AA realized, that it was hard to get somebody sober in the back of a church. You know, that this is our fellowship. You know, I don't know about y'all, but even being sober for quite a long time now, or at least I think I've been sober for a while, you know, I have to be real careful about going into this neighborhood in between my ears, because every time I go into that neighborhood, there's some dark alleys and I get mugged. And, you know, one thing that helps me out a lot is, you know, if laughter is a medicine, I try to stay heavily medicated. You know, I'm always joking and trying to be happy, you know. You know, by nature, I have a negative battery. And I have to go to, I'm telling you, my wife, we used to laugh because we'd go to places like under, you know, parking, you know, or, you know, just walking down the street and street lights and lights all over just go out around me, or used to, you know. I was just such a negative force. But, you know, what helps me a lot is I've hired the GOD lighting company, and I try to get him to light those dark alleys in my neighborhood in between my ears. You know, I am a miracle, and right now I'm standing in a room full of miracles. And if you don't feel like you're a miracle, keep coming back. You know, miracle, the definition is an extraordinary and astonishing happening that is attributed to the presence and action of an ultimate authority or divine power. And, you know, I have to believe that God saved me for a reason. You know, a lot of my friends aren't here anymore. You know, I'm 71. I mean, that, you know, that's not young, but, you know, there's only one or two of my party buddies that are left. And, you know, and tell you the truth, a lot of them wouldn't be friends with me anymore, because I don't know if they were jealous that I was sober or they didn't want to be reminded that, you know, there was a different way to live, you know. They might have died of COVID, they might have died of this, but, you know, cancer or whatever, but, you know, I watched them drink themselves to death. And, you know, hell is just a place void of God. And that can be in between your ears, like I'm saying, you know, And I was really close, you know. But let's see, there was something else that I wanted to touch on, but I probably won't be able to find it. But, you know, I think, you know, I am just blessed, you know. I've been sober for 24 years and 9 months and 3 or 4 days, but who's counting? You know, I don't work a perfect program. You know, I can't say that I'm always working on the steps, but I can tell you I'm living the steps. You know, that, you know, that I've been given a second chance, and you know, I have a, you know, I was one of the original people at New Day. You know, it just happened to be that the fellas that helped start New Day, I live just a couple miles away. If you ever go to New Day, you wonder why we have an AA meeting beside a bar. But in the beginning, there was a business in between. There was two guys that owned this furniture company, offices to go or something like that. No, it was Offices to Go. No, it wasn't Max. No. Office Max is still in business. Okay. But, and we started meeting there. But to tell you the truth, you know, until I had to go back to work, you know, I'm not on a winning streak right now, I can tell you that. You know, I've still got plenty of excuses to drink. Of course, I didn't need much of any. But, you know, I retired for a pretty long time, and all of a sudden, after the pandemic, I kind of ran out of money. And what with inflation, what I thought I could retire on, it wasn't enough. So it was very humbling to have to go back to work, and especially since, you know, nobody loved you after you get a certain age, and having to take jobs that, you know, I would have never even, you know, that I thought I had graduated past all that by now. But, you know, but you have to take life as, you know, the pros and the cons. I mean, actually, I'm kind of blessed that I went back to work because I get to be around people, and I drive a lot, so I get to see things. And tell you the truth, since I've been back to work, I come by here at least once a week or so, and I go by and look at this church. I say, I bet that's where that meeting is. You know, Ralph talks about that meeting in Suffolk. I bet that's where it is. And gosh, it is here. And I just feel so blessed to be able to speak tonight. And I hadn't spoken in a while, so I was a little nervous about it. But, you know, tonight, you know, I'm definitely, I hope that I said something that somebody enjoyed. And like I said, you know, if laughter is a medicine, I try to stay heavily medicated. So I hope that I said something to make you giggle a little bit. Because, you know, we can sit there and cry about the stuff we've done, or we can kind of giggle about it. Because, you know, once your butt's not on fire anymore, you know, then, you know, like I said, you know, God saved me for a reason. And I know that he saved y'all for a reason, because this is a terrible disease, and, you know, it doesn't want you to live, that's for sure. But I guess that's all I got to say about that tonight. Thank you for letting me speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's very interesting. It's really interesting. Did you? The 10 step, you want to come up and talk?
Sure. Jake, we're down alcoholic.
Okay.
Gary, thank you for sharing your story. I remember the first time I went to New Day. That actually was my first home group. I finally decided after 3 years of binge drinking, I'd been sober for a couple years, and then went back out. And that three-year stint, it took me way less time to get down into the dumps. And I finally came to, and I was like, all right, I'm going to go do the AA way this time, because before it was a different one. And I lived in Kempsville, and I didn't have a car. I had a bicycle, and I rode my bicycle to New Day. And that, I think it was the first or second meeting that I went to. Well, the first one I went to, I was like, oh, that's right by Footers. That's where I used to go all the time, you know? I was like, I think I've stumbled by this door, I don't know how many times, and didn't know there was an AA meeting there, you know? So it's funny that you say that. And then the second meeting I went to there, they had a live band, and you could hear the band through the walls. They were playing some good, you know, bar music, and I was not at ease with that at all. I was angry when I heard that, because I was like, oh, they're having so much fun over there, playing pool, smoking cigarettes, and drinking beers and taking shots. It's my kind of thing, you know. So I raised my hand in the middle of the meeting. I was like, I said, what in the heck are we doing here? How are we having an AA meeting when we got this going on over here? You know, I was like, I can't stand this meeting. You know, I said something to that effect. And then the next guy rose his hand. He's like, hey, there's a 7-Eleven right down the road too. You know, as soon as you leave here, you're free to go wherever you want. You can get beer, booze, anywhere. So it doesn't matter that there's what's happening. And it was very distracting. Like, it was loud, right? But I learned very quickly in that moment that, because at first I thought people were going to be on my side, like, yeah, let's leave, you know. But everybody in there was like, hey, it is what it is. Like, I could leave here and drive home, and on the way home think about stopping off at a bar, going into a 7-Eleven, going into a grocery store, and getting a case. What's to stop me from doing that, you know? So I knew that it wasn't the bar's fault, it was my fault that I felt that way, because I am an alcoholic. So it is a miracle that I did not go back out and drink that day. But I listened to what you guys were saying, and it's a miracle that I have been sober for the last 10 years. Because I want to say maybe 6 months ago, I started to really kind of press into what step 10 is. And we're all, you know, we're still in October. It took me 10 years to finally give step 10 relevance daily, moment by moment. And it's a miracle that I did not take another drink. Came close to some divorces many times with my wife. Came close to some hurting people, because I too have an anger problem, right? If I had known then what I know now about what could be the antidote to my anger, and really just it being disturbed in general, it took me a long time to get to that point, though. So step 10 tells me that, you know, it says, you know, it says in the book, you know, daily reprieve this, and, you know, working, you know, vitally, it's vital to my sobriety to work strenuously with others, work strenuously on my steps. I think step 10 is one of the steps that I think kind of, like, that is what step 10 is, you know, because it tells me that I need to take an inventory all the time. It can happen while I'm driving down the road, right? Somebody, you know how many times I've been disturbed today? I've been disturbed, I can't even count. So I have a job to do. My job is to make sure that I stay on what those inventory means. But in order to know what an inventory is, I have to have already done it, right? So it's a miracle that we get that alcoholics can stay sober long enough to even get to step 10, to get to step 4, right? Because if you do it the way that me and my sponsor do it, he led me through the big book from the preface, right? And my job was to stay sober long enough to be able to get to these steps, right? Well, if I'm meeting once a week with my sponsor, and he starts in the big book, and we start at the preface, it takes a while to get to those, you know, those principles, those steps. It can take a little time. for me it took a long time, because when I got step four, I took my time on step four and I didn't do it right away, you know. It took me way longer than it should have. But he said, if you spend 10 minutes a day, 10, 15 minutes a day on your step four, you'll have it done in no time. And I was like, oh yeah, that's great advice, you know. And it took me like, gosh, 5 months to do a step four, right? Because I'm lazy. I've got a lot of character defects, you know. I'm lazy, slothful, right? And it's, after a while, it started to feel like an unpaid bill, right? I was like, all right, I gotta get this done. Because I could tell every time I saw him in a meeting, like he's like, he's just thinking, he's not doing a step four, he's not doing a step four. when he probably wasn't. But my sponsor's got a way of making you feel like that without even saying it. Without even saying it. Every once in a while, you'd be like, how's that step four going? So then I finally did it. We did a step five. I was thorough as I possibly could at the time. I think I could have been more thorough, absolutely, knowing what I know now. You can never be thorough enough, it seems like. Or complete, or 100% thorough. But we did a step five, and when we did step five, it was important that I did it with another person. And it was important because when I divulged this information that I've written down, I'm doing it with another guy, my sponsor, who's done it, I don't know how many times he's done a step five. I don't know how many times he's done his own step five or how many times he's done step five with other guys, right? So I have to do it with someone who has the experience, who can tell me, okay, you did a good job, right? That's a good first try on that line item, but let's think of it this way, right? Also, when I'm doing it with him, God's there, right? Because I'm speaking it out, I'm being honest. He's not reading it. He didn't read my step four. He never once ever glanced at my step four. It was us in at night in his SUV and me just reading it off, right? And for me, that was important to realize afterwards, because it's up to me to be honest, to divulge that information. You know, he doesn't care what's even on there. What he cares is that I did it, and I was willing to divulge it to him, willing to take suggestions afterwards, and maybe make a few changes, maybe think of it a little differently. But really, he just wants me to do it, so I learn how to do it. Because I wasn't thinking that I'm going to have to do it for the rest of my life. I just thought I'm just going to one and done. Okay, I'm done, right? But now I know how to do it, and it didn't dawn on me that I was going to have to do it a lot more. Did step five, we did step six. We went into the 12 and 12 in step six, because step six in the big book has got like one or two paragraphs, right? But step six was like, knowing what I know now, back the first time I did a step six with him, it didn't seem important. But step six now, the reason why I'm going through four, five, and six, because in order to know how to do a 10, you gotta know these other ones, right? And we've got time. So, step six are the seven deadly sins, right? So anytime I'm disturbed, I can apply that disturbance, and I can categorize it, I can put it in either one of those seven deadly sins. It covers everything, right? And I do that anytime I'm disturbed, anytime I have a resentment, anytime I get a little angry, anytime someone ticks me off, I gotta do that. Step seven helps me identify it before it became a resentment, right? So, anger, one of the seven deadly sins. Irritated on step seven that my wife did this, or the dog shit the carpet, right? Well, if I had let the dog out, wouldn't have been a problem, right? So step seven helps me find the shortcomings before, right? Before it became like a big thing. And God, all along the way, is supposed to be considered through all these things, right? God helps me identify the character defect, helps me identify the shortcoming, right? And I can do this live. I can do this as a spot check. I'm pissed off. Well, was I pissed off about that, or was I pissed off about something that happened at work, right? My wife has gotten sick and tired of me taking everything out on her because I tell her all the time, it's like, no, it wasn't you, it was this thing at work. Well, why are you always taking it out on me? Stop doing that. That's a shortcoming. I'll take whatever's going on at work or whatever's going on in, you know, reading the newspaper or watching a YouTube video, and I'll take it out on her. And then step eight, all those names on step four, go on step eight for harms done to people. And step eight helps me identify how to make amends to those people. If I spot check it before before harm done, that's what step 10 is telling me to do. Spot check it before harm done. That way I don't have to go and make amends. I can stop it right there. I can stop the behavior right there. So step 10 is about me trying to avoid all of the harms. You know, that's where I'm changing the behavior. And I started doing it more when my wife had enough, and she wanted to divorce me. And she made a lot of moves towards that, you know. And I was like, okay, I think she means it this time. This is for real. Like, we're getting two separate places. This happened like 6 months ago. Okay, 6 months ago. I've been sober 10 years, and I'm still treating my wife like crap. Right? I may not be punching down the doors or punching holes in the walls and putting my hands on her, because I've done that too. But I'm still causing harm. And I was dumbfounded by that. I was, you know, how could this be happening again and again? Why am I doing it? And I didn't blame it on her. I knew that she was right. And instead of pulling away like I wanted to, because the thought crossed my mind, I was like, this ain't crap. This don't work. You guys suck. I thought that. Yeah. After 10 years. And then I thought, no. Because I already knew what I was going to do. I was going to go find a dive bar. And I knew that that's where I wanted to go. If I didn't want to be here, if I didn't want to talk to you guys, if I didn't want to talk to my sponsor, if I didn't want to do the work, that's the only alternative. And I was like, I can't do that. That's in the wrong direction. Let me figure out what I've not been doing, because there's something I'm not doing. There's got to be. So I call up my sponsor, call up some other guys that I knew what to do. And then I pressed into the God thing too. But God showed me, you guys showed me that step 10 is very important to do, and it's something that I can do all day long. Something that I must do all day long. Otherwise, it's just me and here and the dark alleys that you talked about in between my head. It's pretty dark in there, and it can happen like that. So I do need the light, and the light is this purpose that God has given me, right? It's not just not drinking. It's not just that. It's changing my character. My defects of character. And I can't do that on my own. I can't change the way that I think if I'm unwilling to do these things. And God has shown me that, and you guys have shown me that. And I know it works. And I know when it's not working. When it's not working, it's because I'm not doing this. Yeah. So step 10, very important. Thank you.
Thanks, Jacob.